A young black girl stands before a mirror in 1941 Ohio, whispering a prayer that will haunt you long after you've finished reading. She wants blue eyes. Not as a passing wish, but as a desperate conviction that this impossible transformation would finally make her lovable. Toni Morrison's shattering debut novel forces us to witness how beauty standards become instruments of psychological destruction, particularly for black children taught to despise their own reflections. Published in 1970, this work laid the foundation for Morrison's Nobel Prize-winning career and remains one of the most frequently taught and frequently banned books in American literature. Its power lies not in offering easy answers, but in its unflinching examination of how racism infiltrates our most intimate spaces, our families, our bodies, our very sense of self. Pakola Breedlove doesn't simply wish for blue eyes. She believes they would solve everything, that they would transform her from invisible to cherished, from rejected to embraced. This desperate faith in physical transformation reveals how deeply external standards can corrupt internal worth, turning a child's natural desire for love into a quest for impossible metamorphosis. The poison spreads through every interaction, creating hierarchies based on proximity to whiteness. When Pakola spills berry cobbler in the white family's kitchen, Pauline slaps her viciously while comforting the white child, revealing how racism corrupts maternal love itself. Light-skinned Maureen Peel arrives at school with what Morrison calls lynch ropes for braids, connecting colorism to America's violent racial history. Teachers smile at Maureen, classmates defer to her, boys circle Pakola in a macabre ballet of taunts about her darkness. Even candy becomes weaponized. Pakola believes eating Mary Jane sweets featuring a blonde, blue-eyed girl brings her closer to that ideal. To eat the candy is somehow to eat the eyes. Eat Mary Jane. Be Mary Jane. External standards become internal loathing, transforming simple pleasures into vehicles for self-destruction. Behind Pakola's wish lies generations of inherited pain. Her father, Chali, was abandoned as an infant, then traumatized when white men forced him at gunpoint to continue his first sexual encounter while they watched and laughed. Unable to direct his rage toward these men, it would have consumed him, burned him up like a piece of soft coal. He turned it toward the girl beside him. When he locates his biological father, the man rejects him brutally, causing Chali to soil himself before fleeing to weep by a river. Pauline carries her own wounds. A childhood injury left her with a deformed foot and deep unworthiness. Movies taught her destructive lessons about beauty, making her own life unbearable by comparison to silver screen perfection. When she lost a front tooth during pregnancy, everything went then. Look like I just didn't care no more after that. These traumas don't excuse Chali's rape of his daughter, presented in devastating detail, but they illuminate how damage inflicted on parents becomes damage they inflict on their children, an unbroken chain demanding recognition before it can be interrupted. Morrison exposes educational materials as psychological warfare. The Dick and Jane primer, depicting an idealized white family, appears first normally, then without punctuation, then as jumbled chaos. Seeth the cat, it goes meow meow, come and play, come play with Janet the kitten, will not play, 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 play. This deterioration mirrors how black children's identities fracture when measured against impossible white standards. Within black communities, language perpetuates these hierarchies. Geraldine teaches her son Junior the difference between colored people, neat and quiet, and niggers, dirty and loud. Though Junior yearns to play with the black boys he watches from his window, he accepts his mother's prejudices, revealing how anti-blackness operates among black people themselves. Morrison's prose works against these patterns. Her language is lush, musical, rooted in black oral traditions. Describing old women at a deathbed, she writes, "They were through with lust and lactation, beyond tears and terror, their eyes containing a puree of tragedy and humor, wickedness and serenity." This language celebrates rather than denigrates blackness, offering a counterpoint to the self-hatred consuming Pecola. When Pecola becomes pregnant by her father, the community's response exposes its deepest moral failures. Instead of protecting a traumatized child, neighbors whisper that the baby will be the ugliest thing walking and openly hope it won't survive. The narrator confesses, "We honed our egos on her, padded our characters with her frailty." By focusing contempt on Pecola, community members elevate themselves in an oppressive racial hierarchy. Her suffering becomes their tool for feeling respectable. Even kindness arrives complicated. The three prostitutes offer rare acceptance, though their warmth exists alongside worldviews hardened by abuse. The narrator and Frida plant marigold seeds as hope for Pecola's baby. Morrison draws a devastating parallel. "We had dropped our seeds in our own little plot of black dirt, just as Pecola's father had dropped his seeds in his own plot of black dirt." The barren soil becomes a metaphor for a community lacking empathy's fundamental nutrients. Morrison dissects how respectability wounds black communities. Southern girls learn how to do the white man's work with refinement, stripping away the funkiness, that vital essence of passion and natural impulses. Geraldine embodies this destruction, maintaining appearances while withholding affection. This internalized racism exacts a steep price: loss of joy, connection, and authentic self-expression. Characters seek escape from suffocating realities, each attempt proving futile or destructive. Cholly drowns in alcohol, Pauline retreats into movie fantasies before finding solace as the Fisher family's perfect servant. The three prostitutes carve out relative freedom through an alternative moral universe, yet poverty and stigma still confine them. The most heartbreaking attempt belongs to Pecola. After her father's violation and community rejection, she seeks help from Soaphead Church, a fraudulent spiritualist who recognizes her request for blue eyes as at once the most fantastic and the most logical petition he had ever received. He orchestrates cruel deception, promising that if she feeds poison to an old dog, the animal's reaction will signal her wish's fulfillment. Pecola's subsequent madness represents the ultimate paradox, both liberation and imprisonment. In her delusional state, she believes she has received the bluest eyes and creates an imaginary friend who validates her beauty. This psychological fracture allows escape from unbearable reality, but the price is complete disconnection. The narrator captures this tragedy. Pecola wanders through town, her arms flailing like a bird in an eternal, grotesquely futile effort to fly, desperately reaching for a blue void. Like a flightless bird, she remains earthbound, trapped by forces beyond her control. Despite its bleakness, Morrison's novel contains moments of genuine tenderness. When boys torment Pecola, Frida intervenes. The narrator and her sister plant marigold seeds to save Pecola's baby. Though the flowers don't grow, the gesture matters. Two children trying to create beauty in a world determined to destroy it. The novel's final lines acknowledge that this soil is bad for certain kinds of flowers. Certain seeds it will not nurture, certain fruit it will not bear. Yet by naming destruction, Morrison points toward what might still be saved. Pecola's story demands we examine not just individual prejudices, but the systems that teach children to hate themselves. Morrison offers not comfort, but clarity. And in that clarity lies the possibility of creating a world where no child ever prays to disappear.